Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, we'll be talking with Dr. William Blau from UNC about controversies in chronic pain. But first, Adam, we've got some research that matters, and then we're going to have Dr. Curtis back as our coast-to-coast correspondent.
Yeah, speaking of controversies, I think this first research that matters about doctors making mistakes and how do patients think about it is really an interesting topic, and we're really fortunate that there was an article in the Archives of Internal Medicine actually by one of our family medicine attending physicians at the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine.
Yep, Dr. Kistler. She and her team did some research out of UNC looking at perceived mistakes. And so they found that in North Carolina primary care practices that nearly one in six patients believed their doctor had made a wrong diagnosis or a treatment error, and about one in seven of them had changed their doctor as a result of this.
Yeah, now this doesn't say that these mistakes actually occurred, but it suggests that, you know, patients and our listeners, and even I think Christy and I, when we're patients, that you pick up on things that occur in the doctor-patient encounter. And, you know, if we think that there's a mistake that's occurred, does that mean that we're going to actually leave the practice and find another doctor?
Well, and I think 8% of the patients interviewed or surveyed said that they had experienced a lot or severe harm for this perceived mistake in care. And so many of them never talked to the doctor about it, just left the practice or went to a different doctor. And so you just wonder if you're able to have that conversation with your doctor, that you might be able to understand what happened and then not suffer thinking that a mistake was made, or if it was made, to be able to come to terms with it, or at least talk about it.
Yeah, I think the very first thing is that what this suggests to me and to all our listeners is that if you think there's a mistake that's occurred, ask about it. You know, ask to see the lab report, ask to see the x-ray, ask why this particular treatment. And the doctors frequently, if they do make a mistake, the research has shown, Christy, that if the doctor says, "I'm sorry," that actually works a lot of the times. And so let's have the conversation and let's not hide the fact that mistakes happen in every field, including medicine.
Mm-hmm. Another thing to promote the communication. Okay, the next one is about new depression guidelines. And this was reassuring to me.
Not controversial,
actually, that the American Psychiatric Association came out with the first update on depression treatment in over 10 years.
Yeah, and there are certain things that are really important for all our listeners to know, which is that, first of all, everyone knows depression is really common, but that there are certain really established treatments for depression, some of which you may not be aware of. Certainly, you're aware of medications and what's called CBT or cognitive behavioral therapy or therapy, talk therapy and medications. You know those are good, but there's other things you may not know.
Well, the most striking one to me is the recommendation for everyone to have regular exercise, as the studies have shown that really improves symptoms, especially in older adults and people with chronic medical problems.
Yep. And that also, when you come to see the doctor, ask your doctor, you know, to do a rating scale to get a better sense of how severe or how much you're benefiting or how much you're not benefiting from certain treatments. And then there are other treatments besides medications and talk therapy.
So one of them is called ECT. It's a kind of shock therapy that there's good data to support.
Better than many of the other treatments, and it's there for pretty severe depression that's not responding to other treatments.
And there are newer treatments like magnetic stimulation of the brain that also is supported in the studies.
Yeah, and I think we may even want to talk about that with one of the experts that's doing this, because it's not something that most people probably are aware of, that there's treatments using pulse magnetic field stimulated to certain areas of the brain, as well as vagus nerve stimulation, in which patients would be really appropriate. But to know that there are treatments for depression that we can treat the great majority of all depression with.
Well, Adam, we've had a chance to touch on the new depression guidelines as well as perceived mistakes and people changing their doctor and really the need to talk to your doctor if you think an error has been made.
Yeah, and you know, I think right now, Christy, it'd be great for us to bring in our Coast to Coast correspondent to tell us what's on his mind today, controversy or not, Dr. Peter Curtis, one of the founding members of family medicine in the United States. Welcome back to Your Health, Dr. Curtis.
Thank you very much.
We are so glad to have you back as our Coast to Coast correspondent, and we're wondering what's on your mind this week.
Well, I'm just recovering from having my cataracts operated on.
So that's...
How'd that go?
Well, it went badly and well at the same time.
Well,
let's
hear about the bad first.
The bad was that my cataracts were fairly mature, but I also suffered from another problem, which was many, many floaters inside my eye.
And we actually hear that from lots of patients saying they have floaters all the time, and sometimes those are affiliated with cataracts, huh?
Meaning where you're seeing little objects floating in your vision?
Well, it was more like lace curtains floating across my eyes.
Oh.
Well, that's kind of pretty.
And that was in the what's called the vitreous humor in the middle of the eye, the big global part.
But not very funny because you don't really want to be seeing those lace curtains.
No.
Yeah, okay.
But if I had my cataracts replaced, it would not have made much difference to these floaters.
Huh, okay. So those were going to stay.
So anyway, I went ahead and I had one done first, and the lady, a very charming and efficient ophthalmologist, removed the cataract, but unfortunately the lens bag ruptured.
Not a good thing, right?
So the lens ruptured into the vitreous.
Oh.
And when I woke up the next morning, all I could see was dirty water out of that eye, like dishwater.
That's a little scary, isn't it?
Very scary.
Yeah.
I thought maybe I'm not going to see again.
Oh.
Was this out of both eyes or just one eye?
That was one eye.
Uh-huh.
And she told me, you know, when I rushed back and she told me, well, this only happens in 3% of all the surgeries.
And somehow that makes you feel better that you're in that rare patient.
I said, that's because I'm a doctor.
Of course.
Nurses and doctors always get the complications.
Wow.
It's one of those laws of the healthcare system.
So what happened to you?
Yeah, what happened?
So I had to go and see another man who specializes in vitreous areas of the eye, and he washed it out. So that was my second procedure. And lo and behold, I could see very well.
Great.
Is that the good news?
This was all probably because of kind of a weakness in my eyes because, you know, I'm very short-sighted. So I probably had a genetic weak bag that held the lens. So my next operation was with Mr. Vitreous, or Dr. Vitreous, as I called him. And he did both the cataract replacement and another washout of my other eye.
It happened, the rare thing happened to the second one too?
Well, he said that it was likely to happen again.
Okay.
So I decided to go the whole hog.
And, so if for all our listeners out there who are thinking of cataracts, what's the advice?
Well, the advice is to realize that, you know, a small percentage may have some problems. On the other hand, if you do have a problem, you may end up by seeing better than you would have done in the first place, which is what happened to me.
So now you feel like, are the curtains gone?
Yeah, the curtains are gone, and I see extremely well, so I'm doubly happy.
And is it a gorgeous day in Seattle?
It's a gorgeous day because it isn't raining.
Well, that's
actually the weather's pretty good.
Well, that's a good story, and I think there's some morals there. Thank you for sharing that with us, Dr. Curtis.
My pleasure.
We'd like to thank Dr. Peter Curtis, our new Coast to Coast correspondent, for being with us today. And we sure look forward to hearing what's on your mind the next time we talk. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we will be talking about controversies in chronic pain, and we are fortunate to have an expert in the field.
Yeah, this is a topic that Christy and I really have an interest in. It impacts so many of our patients. We know it impacts so many of you as listeners, given how many people have chronic pain in the United States in any given year. And with us today is Dr. William Blau from the UNC School of Medicine, the Division and Department of Anesthesiology. Dr. Blau did his undergraduate work at one of the state universities of New York, the SUNY Stony Brook system. He did his graduate work in ecology and biology at Cornell before moving to North Carolina and going to medical school at the University of North Carolina, along with residency and then ultimately anesthesiology. Dr. Blau has been the director of the Anesthesiology Pain Management Program for much of the last 15 years, and currently is also the director of the Pain Medicine Training Program at UNC, a one-year fellowship program, and has seen thousands upon thousands of patients with chronic pain. Welcome to the show, Dr. Blau.
Thank you.
Dr. Blau, glad to hear you're a Tar Heel. First of all, we've hit it off strong. Adam and I love to hear more about people's story, about our guests, and particularly with you, how you became fascinated in chronic pain as a medical student. It's being a teacher of medical students, I know it's not the most common thing that medical students get excited about. So how did that excite you?
Well, like much of my career, it actually was a roundabout way. In fact, as a medical student, it was anesthesiology that most fascinated me because it seemed to me, in contrast to other areas of medicine, to be much more like science, people sitting there recording numbers and monitoring and so on. And it's interesting that chronic pain management has grown as a subspecialty of anesthesiology because in so many ways it is so dramatically opposite of the rest of what anesthesiologists do, and that we're dealing with very, unfortunately, unscientific issues, dealing with very complex problems that patients have. But it does bring you back more towards the traditional role of being a physician and having a long-term relationship with patients. And I think as an anesthesiologist, that's one of the things that often attracts people into the subspecialty of pain medicine and chronic pain in particular.
Well, I know that you know, again, chronic pain or severe pain, it's probably a universal experience of the human condition. And as you just mentioned, in anesthesia, you can't imagine today really people undergoing surgery, at least in the Western world and most of the world, without anesthesia because you want to ensure that you relieve pain.
Sure.
And yet here you have patients coming to you day after day who have pain. So I would imagine the draw, or at least one of the draws for you, is this real ability and desire that's innate in who you are as an anesthesiologist that you really need to do something to help them not experience pain.
That's absolutely true. And that is one of the ways in which the subspecialty of pain medicine grew out of anesthesiology. The anesthetic care, as you point out, includes pain control during surgery, but also anesthesiologists became more involved in pain control immediately following surgery and then beyond, because not all pain resolves. And there were no other medical specialties who really adopted this as an area of practice. And anesthesiologists had some special skills with regard to nerve blocking procedures that could, if not be long-lasting, at least could be somewhat profound in their immediate effect on controlling pain. And so it was a natural outgrowth of what anesthesiologists were already doing.
Well, one of the challenges I would imagine, just by definition of it being chronic pain, is the fact that there's not a quick fix in many situations.
Well, that's absolutely true. One of my favorite sayings is that chronic pain is chronic disease, and our goal in most cases, for better or for worse, is to assist the patients in managing that disease. Unfortunately, rarely are we able to truly cure what's causing the chronic pain.
Well, one of the things we promised is we were going to talk about some controversies in chronic pain, and one of those is pain medications. So narcotic pain medications, really strong, we call them opioid medicines like Percocet and Vicodin and
Oxycodone.
There are lots of different ones. And there was a lot of controversy, both from the doctor perspective and the patient perspective, about being on these medications.
Absolutely.
Are there, I mean, what
How do you approach it?
Yeah.
Well, that is extraordinarily complicated right now.
Sure. Answer that.
Why is it complicated?
Because on the one hand, there are so many different issues that it touches on, both with regard to the doctor-patient relationship, just basic questions about medical care, but legal questions, public health issues. It puts the physician in a fairly unique position of having to be responsible in a very significant way to many other outcomes, responsible for many other outcomes, other than simply how much pain relief the patient gets from a given medication.
Because we could harm people by giving them too much medication, or because people – why?
Well, there is always the potential for harm. The physician, his or herself, may also be subject to sanctions of some kind if it's perceived that the conduct of prescribing pain medications is not being done properly. So there's some liability that we are subjecting ourselves to.
Meaning we could lose our license if we didn't do it responsibly.
And there are even some physicians who have gone to prison. Hmm. Yes.
Well, and one of the things that we hear about, at least I hear about, is from a patient perspective, the doctors won't give me what I know I need to relieve my pain.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the ibuprofen-like drugs didn't work. I've been to physical therapy. I've done all of the alternative things, and the pain medicines relieved
my patients.
and the medication, the narcotic medications work. Can I give them to them safely? Should a patient be asking their doctor when they get pain relief from opioids? Should they be asking their doctor, and should the doctor give them under those circumstances?
Well, that highlights a couple of the difficulties that I was alluding to, because that sort of decision has to be made outside of just the doctor-patient relationship, and especially not necessarily what that patient happens to feel might be best for them. And it's interesting because I think, I'm sure you're aware, over the past 15, 20 years, there's been tremendous consciousness raising about the importance of the management of pain, both within the medical community and I think in the general public. The Joint Commission, who accredits hospitals, has focused a lot of attention on this. There's been a tremendous amount more in the press over the past 10 or 20
years.
Right.
Every patient that comes in, no matter what they're there for, gets asked a pain score. And for many years, we were encouraged that we were under-prescribing pain medications.
Right. So there's a much greater expectation, I think, on the part of the patients that something can and should be done for their pain, even if that something includes a narcotic medication. But the decision to use a narcotic medication has to weigh a lot of potential benefits and potential disadvantages, including the broad range of sometimes very significant side effects that these medications can cause, the fact that they're not even – despite the fact that they're probably the most powerful pain medicines that we have available, there's no guarantee of controlling every type of pain that there is, particularly in the long-term setting. There are issues about that particular patient's lifestyle and potential risk for either abusing the medication, using it for the wrong reasons, or even diverting the medication so that it's taken by others for whom it's not prescribed. And as I'm sure you know, there's been a tremendous increase in drug-related overdoses, particularly narcotic-related overdoses, in patients who report for medical care in an overdose situation.
And there are also concerns about a patient. I have a friend who doesn't want to take them because she's afraid of being labeled. So the patient perspective on that part is important too.
Absolutely.
And I know we're going to take a short break. When we come back, let's pick up on this kind of fear of from the patient's perspective and the reality from prescriber's perspective and this tension that really comes into play here. We're talking with Dr. William Blau of the UNC Department of Anesthesia about chronic pain management. We'll be right back with UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. William Blau from UNC about controversies in chronic pain and chronic pain management. And we've been talking a lot about the difficulties of prescribing and perhaps needing these narcotic pain medications as it comes to treating chronic pain.
Yeah, one thing, Dr. Blau, I wanted to ask you, there's a fear that physicians that people who come in asking for pain medications are pain seekers.
Or drug seekers.
Drug seekers, yeah. Drug seekers, not pain seekers.
Notice our pain.
But are drug seekers. And we're kind of trained and then we're kind of cautious about wanting to do that. I mean, how often truly in your experience are people really looking to get medications to sell them or really abuse them in some other way?
Well, first I have to preface my answer by saying that I have a real issue with the term drug seekers because mm-hmm. the vast, vast majority of patients who are seeking drugs are seeking pain relief. And so I think we have to distinguish that from the patient who truly has a substance use disorder, which is what we're really concerned about, or patients who are likely to divert and sell medications and
right.
so on. I think in a general practice, it's relatively rare that that's going to be a problem. I think in a practice such as ours where all we're seeing day in and day out are patients with pain, many of whom are already on pain medications, there's a much higher risk of encountering patients whose ulterior motives may be different than just pain control.
I mentioned earlier a friend of mine who has pain and is afraid to be on these narcotic medications because she knows she's afraid that medical doctors and other people might treat her with that judgment that sometimes comes that either she's quote-unquote crazy or that she's got problems or that she's seeking medications that aren't indicated, yet her doctors are recommending it. How do you handle that?
Well, that's difficult because I think she has a legitimate concern. There's certainly among the public a stigma, I think, associated in many places with patients being on narcotic medications, but even within the medical community. I think there are many physicians who will draw certain assumptions about a patient simply on the fact that they're being treated with narcotic medications. And many physicians in primary care will refuse to be involved in that form of management.
One of the controversies I sometimes hear is that, you know, pain is one of these things that you can't see. It's hard to measure it. I mean, you can do a scale and say, but it's what the patient reports to you. Is that a problem in your field? Because I would imagine for a lot of primary care doctors, you know, someone comes in and says, I have great pain, but they don't look like they're in great pain. You think, what's up?
Well, in many ways, that is the crux of the problem because there are so many other diseases where there are objective findings or measurements that can be made to validate the patient's complaints, if they even have complaints. In our field, in patients with pain, it is a very subjective experience. The actual definition of pain incorporates the fact that it's not just the stimulus that the patient perceives or receives, but it's how the patient emotionally and cognitively responds to that stimulus. So pain itself is by definition subjective, and there is no absolute way to measure it. And so most comprehensive pain practices will incorporate various types of screening questionnaires and instruments, as well as an interview with a clinical psychologist to really understand in a more full and complete way the patient, what they are actually experiencing and how they respond to pain.
Another controversy I'd like to raise, and maybe it's not controversial to you, but is this idea that being on chronic medications or the opioid medicines makes it worse over time for a patient perhaps with fibromyalgia, that maybe that over time, because they get more tolerant to the medicines, might need more and more of it over time, this perception that this medicine's just not really helping the condition and maybe making the situation worse.
Well, I agree that is a risk. And as I mentioned earlier, even our best, strongest pain medicines are not ideal and don't work for every sort of pain. There is a problem potentially with the development of tolerance when the patients will no longer the medications will no longer work as well for the patients. Although there are relatively long-term studies that demonstrate that it's not going to happen in an out-of-control fashion in every patient, that some patients can be maintained long-term on steady doses of medication. But it's not for all patients. And you mentioned the fibromyalgia group of patients, which is a generalized pain disorder. For various reasons, I think that's one of the types of pain disorders for which narcotics may in the long term create more problem than they're going to provide benefit.
We're talking with Dr. William Blau of the UNC Anesthesia Department about chronic pain. And Dr. Blau, tell us a little bit. I mean, you know, if a patient comes to Christy and I or other primary care physicians, we're really talking about medications, physical therapy. We have some limitations in our kind of our armamentarium. You have some more tools being a chronic pain specialist. What are some of those tools that you use, and how effective are they?
Part of how our approach may differ, or at least the resources that we have available to us, is the emphasis, again, on addressing the psychological side of pain as well as the physical side of pain. I wish we had two or three times the amount of resources to do that than we have, but what we have is even more than what many primary care physicians are going to have immediately at their disposal. In addition to that, and in the appropriate patients, a rehabilitation-oriented approach, in other words, learning to function better with the pain or discomfort that you have. As anesthesiologists and pain specialists, we also have what are referred to as interventional techniques, meaning various types of nerve injections, injections of steroids in and around the spine are done very frequently in our practice for spine-related problems.
And do they work?
To a variable degree.
Okay.
For some of the patients, some of the time is unfortunately the best that we're able to say.
Mm-hmm.
And ultimately, for pain that is refractory to everything else and is severe enough to really impair someone's quality of life, there are more aggressive interventional techniques such as implantation of infusion pumps that drip medicine directly into the spine, and implantation of spinal cord stimulators that treat pain in a whole different way with a low-level electrical stimulation.
When a person is coming to terms with the fact that this pain is not just, I have this pain and there's a fix for it, but that it's more of a long-term something they're going to have to deal with, more of a chronic nature, where do you send them for information or for reliable information about chronic pain?
Well, for our own patients, hopefully a certain amount of education is part of the therapeutic relationship that we have with those patients, is actually spending time with them and being able to educate them about the nature of their problems. But there are so many patients out there, whether they're coming to physicians or not, who experience and suffer chronic pain. There are a variety of avenues via the internet, I'm sure, that can be found. One that I would recommend is the American Pain Foundation. I don't have the web address, but I'm sure if
you Google
searches
American
that
Pain
name, American
Foundation.
Pain Foundation, you'll find it, yes.
Well, we've been talking with Dr. William Blau of the UNC Department of Anesthesiology about controversies in pain management. And I can say one thing that's not controversial. It's really enlightening for Christy and I to talk with you today and to be able to open up a conversation. And it's just opening the conversation here.
Absolutely.
But as you were talking, I was thinking, God, we'd love to have you back to talk about spinal stenosis and its management of pain, osteoarthritis, and we could go on and on.
Sure.
Thank you so much for being our guest today.
Thank you, Dr. Bob.
Thank you.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to talk about your questions and attitudes towards medical care.
And you can write us with your questions, and we'll talk about them on an upcoming show. Send them to yourhealth@unc.edu or call us at 919-966-8081.
And now we'll have our executive producer, Julie Steiner, read some of the questions and house calls for today.
I wanted to share something with your listeners. I'm an educated professional who saw niacin tablets in the store. I thought of them as a B vitamin, so I bought them and thought they were just a good daily supplement. Today, my whole body turned red, and I went to my doctor worried about a serious skin disease. He quickly made the link between the niacin and my rash. I felt so stupid, but maybe my story will help other listeners.
Thank you for sharing. I mean, that is a common scenario with niacin, to have that sort of a reaction.
And we certainly could understand how you might feel stupid. We would never say that, however, certainly not to your face, because we've probably done something similar.
You
know, if we told you the things we had done that had bad outcomes. But, you know, like Christy says, it happens a lot.
And niacin is a great over-the-counter option to help improve your cholesterol panel. It can decrease those triglycerides, which are part of that. But this flushing, as we call it, that where you feel hot and red, is a common side effect. You can prevent it, though, with taking an aspirin of 325 milligrams 30 minutes prior to taking the niacin.
And then some people can actually take a sustained-release niacin, mm-hmm. and that you can get even by a prescription that may help prevent this problem. But the reality is, a lot of people actually end up not taking niacin because of this problem, or they don't want to take aspirin at the same time. And so it's probably not our first line choice for lowering cholesterol. That would certainly be diet.
And then exercise.
And then usually some other medications, things like Zocor, Lipitor, those HMA coase reductase. I like that
name. Or
the
statins.
Statins, yes.
Okay. Hopefully that's helpful to you, and hopefully your flushing will go away. Julie, what's
next? Thanks for sharing.
Yes. Julie.
I went to my doctor's office recently, not a UNC clinic, but a private practice. And the receptionist said to me without looking up, name, that will be a $25 copay. No hello, no eye contact, no welcome to our practice. Later that day, I went to get my hair cut. When I entered, one of the hairdressers looked up and said, welcome, we will be with you in a moment. Is that okay? With a smile and eye contact, too. Amazing, isn't it? The doctor's office treated me far worse than the hairdresser, who ironically charged far less.
Wow.
Thank you for sharing that painful reminder of what we all need to be mindful of.
Well, and, you know, increasingly we're realizing healthcare is a service industry. And so you're really highlighting that if we're providing service to our patients, we need to treat them with respect and treat them as if we're serving them, look you in the eyes and talk to you like a person.
Well, and it's this whole emphasis on really creating part of this primary care medical home that you feel as comfortable here as you do in your home, in your doctor's office, that you get cared for like you're a family member. And that starts when you walk in the door. And frankly, if this happens to you again, or if it happens to us, I think we should say something to that office that, hey, you know, right here in front of you is a person who doesn't feel good or is anxious when they walk in. Most of us aren't anxious when we go to the hairdresser, but yet if they can do such a really nice job, we can learn from them, and it's incumbent.
Thank you for sharing. It's a great, great point. Julie, what's next?
I am 55 years old and have had many symptoms over the last 5 years, including fatigue and headaches. My doctor said I was depressed. While I initially resisted the diagnosis, thinking I must have something real, I now realize that I was depressed, and it is real. I started medication, and I'm finally starting to feel better.
Well, you know, that's really important information that our listeners share with us, and something that I think is one of the kind of the myths of depression.
Yeah, fatigue and headache are common problems, and there are so many possibilities. So it was good that you came in to talk to your doctor. He or she probably did a few tests to check your thyroid and check your blood, just make sure that there's nothing else going on. But a really common cause of those symptoms is depression, and it sounds like your doctor helped you figure it out.
And one of the really common misconceptions out there is that depression and anxiety aren't real.
Exactly.
You know, just like we were talking about with chronic pain today, Christy, you know, you can't see chronic pain. You can't see the depression inside the person's body, but you hear the story. And when someone has chest pain that comes from anxiety, that's just as real for people as the chest pain from a heart attack. Matter of fact, we sometimes make a mistake and think one is the other. Same thing with depression.
I'm so glad you are feeling better and that the medications are helping. And hopefully, you know, as we talked about earlier, exercise and therapy can also be helpful. But certainly glad you have a good relationship with your doctor to help figure that out.
And any listeners that have any types of symptoms that you're worried about, depression, anxiety, is it real? If it's experiencing it by you, it is real no matter what it is. Please talk with your doctor about it.
Julie, we have time for one more.
I am a 25-year-old man who recently was told I have a herniated disc in my back. I did not injure it. Does this mean I will have chronic pain in the future? I hope not.
I hope not, too.
Ditto. Because at age 25, boy, that must be a frightening kind of thought. You have a herniated disc. We can't even imagine, unless you've had a herniated disc, the kind of pain that is. That's really painful.
Mm-hmm. And I guess it's hard. We would want to know how that was diagnosed, like what sort of studies did a doctor do and why to be able to know that you had a herniated disc. And then there are also levels of severity, because you can find lots of things on an MRI that might suggest a mild herniation that may or may not go on to cause you problems in the future.
Yeah, you know, the good news is that the great majority, even if herniated discs, because if we did MRIs on a lot of people with back pain, we would see a lot of them actually have a partial kind of disc herniation, that disc slips out and presses on a nerve. But the great majority of those do heal up without surgery. They can heal up with conservative treatment. What sort of things do you recommend for patients that initially present with you with back pain that may or may not have some herniation, Christy?
With initial back pain, I recommend movement, heat or ice. I recommend anti-inflammatory medications. And after the acute part is over, exercises to strengthen those stomach muscles and strengthen your muscles overall
to
support your back.
Core muscles.
Mm-hmm.
And we frequently refer you to a physical therapist to really mm-hmm. work, teach you to do the right exercises, and really work on that strengthening.
So the answer to you about chronic pain in the future is probably not, and we hope not.
Along with you. Well, we've had a chance today to talk not only about the kind of chronic pain and herniated disc, but about depression and it being real and can cause fatigue and headaches.
About the medical industry needing to be a service industry and to treat people with respect.
And the kind of stupid things that we all sometimes do but are good education lessons about all of us about taking over-the-counter supplements like niacin that could cause side effects like flushing.
Yep. Thank you all for sharing, and thank you for listening and for being with us today for your health. We hope we've addressed some issues and concerns that are important to you and to your health. And we want you to write us at yourhealth@unc.edu. Call us at 919-966-8081. Visit us online at yourhealthradio.org or follow us on Twitter by searching for Your Health Radio.
That's a lot of ways you can follow us. Yeah, well, we'd like to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, and our great producer, Julie Steiner. We hope you've enjoyed the show today, and we'll listen to us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of the UNC Department of Family Medicine, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And we'll look forward to talking with you again next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. You can also go to our website, 1360WCHL.com, and click on WCHL On Demand. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360 WCHL.